Hi everyone, Chelsea here. I wanted to drop in before this episode to remind everyone of a couple of things before you listen to the rest of this episode. First off, the very best thing for you to learn the things you need to know is to listen to the 2024 update episode that was posted back in January of 2024. In that short update, I shared the big news of me coming out as transgender and my name now being Chelsea, and that largely being the reason for our hiatus the last 2 years. But obviously, we're back. Just last week, Andrew, Melanie, and I got together and recorded for the first time since the summer of 2022. Coming down the pipeline after this episode, sometime this week or next, is a sort of us getting back in the swing of things kind of episode, and then following that, you will hear our reactions, review, and breakdown of the first episode of Netflix's new live-action adaptation of this series that we all love so much. What do we think so far? You'll have to wait to hear. And we'll be watching and recording episodes for each of the 8 episodes of the Netflix series in the coming weeks and months before we return to our animated series, Rewatch. The episode you're about to listen to, or listening to now, episode 23, was recorded in that summer of 2022 at a time when I was still very much early in my transition and Andrew and Melanie were the only ones who I was out to at that time. That said, it was before I'd started using my new name with them, or with anyone, obviously. And there's nothing more false as a podcaster than re-recording a conversation you've already had. So instead of us revisiting this episode to talk about it again, I figured it was just best to dust this off on my computer, edit it, get it in the feed. But again, going forward, all of our content will have us using my new name, and I would appreciate you using my new name only as well. We are excited to get back into the swing of things, but I do want to temper expectations. We likely still won't be an every week podcast because, let's face it, we are busy. I'm starting a new job. Andrew and Melanie have 3 kids now. We're busy. But we do still love this show and we love talking about it. So we'll keep recording episodes as we're able. We hope you'll be along for the ride and we hope to hear from you. I'll share some contact info right off the bat just because mine in particular is different than when we recorded the episode you're about to listen to. In fact, I'll just share my contact info because honestly, anywhere you reach out to us, it'll be me who interacts with you. So you can find me on Twitter at ChelseaCC_17. That's my name, Chelsea, 2 letter C's_17. That is in the show notes if you want to see it rather than just hear me spell it for you. Or if you have something more detailed to say, something longer form, you can email our email address, xroadspod@gmail.com. Last thing, it would be a big help to us if you dropped us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or on your podcast app of choice so that we can reach a larger audience now that we'll be recording more regularly. And as a personal plea, if you've left us a review before, thank you. But if you used my dead name, I would be grateful if you resubmitted with the right one. Thank you all. Enjoy this episode, and we will talk to you soon. Bye. Welcome to episode 23 of Crossroads of Destiny and Avatar the Last Airbender Universe podcast. Right now we're talking about every episode of Nickelodeon's Avatar the Last Airbender one at a time. I'm Chad Hopkins and I'm joined by my co-hosts Andrew and Melanie Grant. How's it going, guys?
It's good. It's great.
It's great.
It's a little late.
We're recording in a new space for the first time, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Because you all moved apartments within the complex, but there's carpet.
There's carpet.
We're spread out. And
there are less chances of our children throwing themselves downstairs.
Yeah.
So that's always helpful. Always a plus.
Nothing like the 23rd episode happening in a third location.
Yeah. It happens.
Yeah.
It happens.
We moved so much.
A few things to briefly talk about before we get into our episode discussion. We did want to shout out a couple of people. We wanted to shout out Kay Thirst. I believe that's Caitlin Thurston. And then somebody whose screen name is Eng Musing, who both left us reviews on Apple Podcasts recently. And they were both very positive, and we love to see it. So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. We appreciate the time you took.
Thank you. We enjoy making this even infrequently, as it seems.
Oh my gosh.
But we're glad to make something that we enjoy doing and that people will at least seem to be enjoy listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there has been some casting news regarding the upcoming Netflix live adaptation. I don't have all that information in front of me, but one of the main things to celebrate is that James C., who voices the Cabbage Man in the series, is going to be portraying the Cabbage Man in the live action series. It's pretty great.
Excellent.
Already better than the movie.
Already instantly better than the Shyamalan mess. And oh gosh, then the guys. Other thing to celebrate is that Avatar Studios, which is the real thing to get excited about because it is headed by Nickelodeon and Michael and Brian, who created the original property, they have announced the upcoming production of 3 animated movies, and they just announced at San Diego Comic-Con this past weekend that the first of those movies is going into production early next year, and it is featuring Aang and friends.
What? So
that's really exciting.
Yeah. It's supposed to be like between
teenage Aang and friends, right?
Yeah, it's like younger adult, I believe.
It's going to be awesome.
Between the avatars, essentially, the series that we already have.
Excellent.
Right.
I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, we're going to be on top of the news and sharing that with you guys as it starts to come out. Just happy to know that the very first thing coming from that production studio is going to be more Aang.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. And that leads us to what we are talking about today. We are continuing our discussion on book 2 of Avatar The Last Airbender. This is chapter 3, Return to Omashu. It was directed by Ethan Spalding, written by Elizabeth Welch, and aired on April 7th of 2006, and it was animated by DR Movie. The summary for the episode: wanting his old friend Bumi to be his earthbending teacher, Aang arrives with his friends in Omashu, only to find it overtaken by the Fire Nation, with Bumi nowhere to be found. Meanwhile, Azula seeks the help of her own old friends to hunt down Zuko and Uncle Iroh. So what are some standout individual moments that maybe just made you smile, made you laugh, that kind of stuff?
I like, what were those called? The little squid thingies?
The pentapus.
The pentapus. Those are so cute. I like the little noises and their little gigglies.
Their little eyes every time you scratch their head.
I know, I love it.
Yeah. You have to like tickle them to get them to detach themselves.
Those were precious. I always enjoy the animals that they have in the show, because then there was like the giant platypus. Just laid an egg randomly. Mm-hmm. Weird.
And Flopsy.
Oh, we got Flopsy.
Yeah, Return of Flopsy.
Honestly, I forgot about Flopsy.
Yeah. It's been a long time because King of Omashu was episode 4 of season.
That was a year and a half ago.
Yeah, episode 4.
It's been a minute. Yeah. So I completely forgot about Flopsy existing.
I wanted to note something that we've maybe even said on the show before, but how are the nation-specific clothing colors not dead giveaways every time? Because we see Sokka and Katara walking around with their earthbending rebels in their waterbending garb. Right.
Blue.
And there's no questions asked. Even Aang, who covers up his head with his airbending monk robe.
As long as his arrow isn't showing, he's not a...
It's completely...
Yeah, absolutely.
Not an airbender.
It's a Clark Kent moment. Puts on
that kind of
glasses.
Thing.
It was a fun episode for Sokka. I liked it.
Yeah.
He was funny.
There was a small moment from Sokka where, as they were sneaking into the city of Omashu, they went through the sewers. And Aang was, of course, using airbending to sort of clear his path. And Katara was using waterbending to clear hers. And Sokka was behind the both of them getting splashed with sewage, which is how he ended up with the pentapus on himself. But this is like super small, maybe not even a major thing, but once Aang climbed into the sewer, Sokka was the first one behind him. But then as we see them traversing the pipe, Sokka was in the tail. Mm-hmm. So he'd let Katara pass him. And I was just nice. He let Katara get in front of him.
Yeah, there's a lot of growth for him.
Yeah.
For sure.
So it's a small thing and maybe not even something they necessarily intended us to think about. But hey,
there
Katara,
it is.
Why it's don't you go in front? Yeah. That kind of thing.
That's a very kind of patriarchal form.
I was gonna say older
thing.
Brother like, yeah, thing to do.
He's the older guy, so he has to. It's like a form of protection, making sure that everyone in front of you is okay and things like that. So I think it's a cute little thing to note that he's still trying to take that place, that, you know, that role, but he kind of he's put in his place essentially by the benders in front of him. That it's obviously not necessary that he takes that role. Mm-hmm. they don't need his protection or anything like that, but it's still
sweet.
Yeah, Sokka still wants to do it for him.
Yeah. So getting to the story of the episode, they make the comment that Ba Sing Se is the only great Earth Kingdom stronghold left now that Omashu seems to have fallen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Katara and Sokka were right at the beginning to suggest that they leave without searching for Bumi? Like, obviously, we've seen the rest of the episode. We know how things progress. We know why Bumi sort of removed himself from things. But without that knowledge, do you think, what are your thoughts on Katara and Sokka saying, hey, Aang, maybe we shouldn't go down there and we should just find somebody else?
I think that kind of just shows that Aang is still a little young in his thought process. He isn't thinking so much as the Avatar and having to complete his missions of learning all of the elements to save the world, because he doesn't have a very long time to do so. He's thinking as, my friend is in trouble, my friend isn't here, I need to go help him. And they mention it multiple times in the show that he is not, Bumi is not a, like a small character. He's a very powerful person. He's a king and he's a very powerful earthbender. So for Aang to think like he has to go and save Bumi and help Bumi like this, I feel like when I was watching it, I was like, he should have really just trusted the process, because it's not like, I guess I was thinking, it's not like Bumi to just willy-nilly say, oh, surrendering, I don't want to do anything. Like, he had a plan and he should have trusted his friend, I think.
Well, this was before we knew anything about what happened to Bumi or that he had surrendered or anything like that. And they mentioned that Aang says something to the effect of, I never thought I'd see Omashu fall. Mm. And here it has fallen. There's Fire Nation symbol emblazoned across the city. And it might be Aang just thinking, what could have happened here that Bumi let this happen? Like, maybe he's not thinking so much that Bumi surrendered or fled or anything like that, but he was overpowered somehow.
Mm. Right. And that means that, I guess in Aang's mind, best case scenario, he's going to see if Bumi's even there alive or not. Mm-hmm. I don't think Katara or Sokka were wrong to be like, weren't we here for an earthbender teacher? This ain't it. We got to go. Like, this is, you know, scratch this off the list. We need to find another plan. I get that you wanted to talk to Bumi. You wanted Bumi to be your teacher. But we're literally avoiding the Fire Nation. And it could not be more clear that Omashu is now part of the Fire Nation. Like,
there's a very big banner.
Right. They have marked the city. They've quote unquote industrialized it. Like, there's a lot of obvious additions to what the Omashu that we have seen before and things like that, mm-hmm. that are very Fire Nation centric, and being out of, you know, away, undetected so far and not involved with anything that's happening in Omashu, they had every opportunity to be like, move on. This isn't where we need to be. And for Aang to go in and be like, no, I think the best case scenario is we go into this obvious Fire Nation occupied city just to see what happened to Bumi. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I get that he wants to go see what happened to his friend, but he's 100 something, mm-hmm. a powerful earthbender. You don't know where he's at. Like, I get that there's some, at best, there's some curiosity there.
But was it use of their time?
Well, yeah, was that the greatest use of their time? I don't think so.
I think Katara and Sokka are both looking at it from that logical perspective of like, mm-hmm. well, Bumi can take care of himself. Whatever has happened here has happened. But I also think they're trying to be compassionate towards Aang, because mm-hmm. Sokka at least sort of hints that Bumi might not have survived this. He might not be around. And if you think back to episode 3 season 1, when they visit the Air Temple and he finds his friend Monkey Atso there, who was his father figure, mm-hmm. that was 100 years removed. Mm-hmm. For him to experience something like that here, it would be worse, because he's seen Bumi recently. Right. He's remade that connection. mm-hmm. and then he would have lost him again. So I think they're being logical about it and saying, hey, we just need to find somebody else to teach you earthbending, mm-hmm. but also trying to save Aang from himself to a certain extent, because they don't want him to experience the same heartbreak over Bumi that he experienced over Gyatso.
Trigger an avatar.
Yeah.
State.
Yeah, and triggering the avatar state, considering just a couple episodes, we had that big moment where they decided that the avatar state was not the path forward.
Right.
Right.
Right. So
it was very dangerous.
If he were to be triggered into the avatar state, something could happen that would result in further dire consequences.
Mm-hmm.
So they do go in. Aang says, this isn't about finding a teacher, it's about finding a friend. And we're introduced to a new character in Omashu. The character's name is Mei. She's voiced by an actress named Cricket Lee. Yeah, her name's Cricket. It's a real interesting name. She's got a real interesting voice. But this character of Mei, from the beginning, her first line in the show is, there really is no fathoming the depths of my hatred for this place.
Mei is a whole vibe. Like, she's not been done for a minute. Like, yeah, she's not very, like, in this episode, obviously, she's fairly prevalent. But going forward, she's here and there. But she doesn't change, and it's amazing.
You know who she reminds me of a little bit is Raven from
Teen Titans. Oh,
Teen Titans. Yeah. She reminds me of Raven.
Same energy.
Yeah.
So she's very bored. She doesn't like being here. It's not that she's like unhappy in the sense that, oh, my life is miserable here. It's, oh, my life is boring here. I wish I was somewhere else.
She's very talented.
Yeah, she is very talented with things like blades, like, and shooting arrows out of these gauntlets.
17,000 arrows on her person.
Yeah. Tiny arrows.
She never ran out or reloaded.
Yeah, so the very first moment where we see what she's capable of, at least a taste of it, Aang and Katara and Sokka are sneaking into the city, and Aang sees that an Earth Nation person is laying a trap for Mei and her family. And he sends down this like landslide within the city, and Aang stops it from happening. So one, that raises some interesting questions of what if Aang hadn't stopped them?
Right. Would they be okay with just killing a family, a baby? Like, that's terrifying.
And then the other thing is, as soon as Mei realizes there's an opportunity for some action and for some stuff to go down, she smiles. Like, we see her smile, and then she's like, the chase is on.
Let's go.
And then as soon as the fight is done, her smile immediately drops.
And she just turns tail and walks back.
It's like a light switch.
Right, yeah.
She's like,
the caption, we watch with closed captions, and it just says, sighs. Like, as soon as the chase is over, they escape. But she's super agile. She's quick. She's adept with her throwing blades and arrows. So we see those talents from her. And it is worth noting her father has been appointed as the governor of Omashu. So that is her connection with what is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see, just skipping around a little bit, we see Azula with her old lady advisors who are real creepy and talking in unison and all that kind of stuff. And they suggest that, you know, going forward, the best thing to capture Zuko and Iroh might not be to carry around the entire royal guard with you. And Azula's like, fair point. Let's find like a special team. Let's assemble an elite ops kind of situation. And she says, let's go visit some old friends. So just like Aang is visiting old friends in Omashu, she's visiting her old friends.
Yep.
And the first old friend she goes to is somebody named Ty Lee. Ty Lee is voiced by an actress named Olivia Hack. And Ty Lee is a circus performer. And Melanie, I was curious, what were some of your initial impressions of Ty Lee?
She was adorable. I liked her. But I feel like she's like adorable all the way until the moment where she's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. So she reminded me of a different character from Final Fantasy. And her name is escaping me right now, but she's very bubbly. The whole interaction that I saw with Azula and Ty Lee is that, you can tell it was weird to see Azula friendly with somebody. That whole thing was weird. And like, they embraced each other. She hugged somebody without like murdering them, which was interesting.
Yeah. We find out they were classmates at the Royal Fire Academy for girls.
Yeah. And then it's interesting that guess it being a Royal Academy, like Azula's dad is the Fire Lord. Then Ty Lee's dad is a nobleman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Mei's dad is now a governor of a city. And that's interesting. Anyway, just to see their interaction was, I thought it was like, oh, maybe Azula does have a kind of like a heart, and this friend of hers is bubbly enough for the both of them to kind of like interact and be. And then she totally like low key threatened her during the circus performance. I'm like, oh yeah, no. Okay. Yeah. There we are. Found her. So I think with Ty Lee, I think she realizes that although it's a friendship, it's a very dangerous friendship, and doesn't cross her. She tried, but agrees to go and join her anyway, even though it's something that she doesn't want to do. She's a bully.
I was thinking about that whole interaction between the two of them, because you were commenting on this while we were watching. It was strange how Ty Lee originally says, no, I don't want to join you. I like the life I've built here. This is what I want to do. And then Azula basically endangers her. She's watching the performance and, well, oh, why don't we set the net on fire? She's not going to fall, so why does it matter? Oh, and do you have any dangerous animals here? Let's let those out too.
I was like, dang.
So I'm just trying to think of like what Azula's ultimate play was. Like if this didn't win over Ty Lee and Ty Lee hadn't hung up her performer clothes at the end of that night and said, okay, I'm going to join you, Azula. What would the step have been the next day? Like further endangerment, or would she have tried a new tactic? It was just like a weird.
It was really strange.
I don't know exactly. It's weird that Azula would pursue this path and expect that specific outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like I just keep going to King George and Hamilton and I will kill your friends and family to remind you of my love. Like that's
exactly. Yeah.
Like, I think the real tactic here is Ty Lee obviously enjoys the people she's with. And if Azula is going to stay and endanger Ty Lee, she's going to also stay and endanger all of Ty Lee's new friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, to save her circus friends, she's going to be like, hey, Azula, that's fine. No, we're good. Let's clear out of here. Let's light other things on fire. Oh, I didn't even think about it like that. Away from the people I like. Additionally, there may be some sense of like, obviously they're highly trained, highly skilled individuals. So Azula like challenging her norm might be some kind of sense of like, yeah, what you're doing is kind of lame. Like you're very capable and I can make this more challenging for you, or you can come with me and really express your talents somewhere else. That's the only logic I can find in this, is either she's either endangering people she loves or challenging the fact that she's kind of plateaued. And if you were real, you would come with me, essentially. Like,
that's fair. And ultimately, Ty Lee does say the universe is giving me some pretty strong signs that I should come with you.
Yeah, it was just the whole situation was manipulative and creepy.
And very Azula. Like,
yeah,
that does raise a question, though. How much was Ty Lee aware of the fact that Azula was pulling the strings? She was up on a tightrope.
Mm.
That's true.
Maybe she just thought the circus company had turned against her. Like, right. I don't need to be here anymore.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I would think she's smart enough to know that every other night the performance has been just fine.
Yeah.
And then this one night that Azula is there and is watching, all of a sudden these horrible, dangerous things are happening.
Yeah.
That, and I think kind of to go against for a second what you're saying, is the announcer for the circus did say in the beginning of like, if there's any ways we can improve this, please let us know.
Right.
And then all the improvements, quote unquote, were happening.
Yeah. Well, Ty Lee does ultimately join Azula, and so they start making their way to Omashu. Meanwhile, as they are meeting with the earthbending resistance in Omashu, Aang learns that Bumi just straight up surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as, like, there was no fight, there was no resistance. It was like, oh, and the Fire Nation's attacking.
His generals were pissed.
Yeah, I'm out.
We were ready to go.
Yeah, this general says, freedom is worth dying for.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote down, is it? Like, Is it? I don't know. And so there's this issue, this struggle between fighting for the home you've lost at risk of life or evacuating to preserve as many lives as possible. And Aang is the one who suggests that second option. And I was wondering, do you think that Aang is considering lives on both sides? Like, if the Earthbenders fight back, some of them are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take some Fire Nation people with them too, though.
And right.
So Aang is just thinking, hey, y'all fight, lots of people on both sides die.
I think that's been proven several times in the past episodes that we've seen that mm-hmm. Aang isn't just, I'm all about the air, airbenders, or I'm all about the fire, or earthbenders, or whatever. He is about all of them
mm-hmm.
and wants to protect. Hasn't he, in several occasions, saved Fire Nation people in battle? Why am I making that up in my brain? Why do I remember that?
He's definitely spoken out against. He is a pacifist in every sense. Like, he's a peacemaker. He doesn't want conflict. In episodes with Zhang Zhang, when he's fighting Commander Zhao, he doesn't attack. He lets him destroy his own fleet, and all the damage done is caused by him.
Mm.
So I think that plays into the fact that even when faced with a threat to himself, knowing that he could overpower Zhao with his own bending skills, he chooses not to.
Right.
It chooses to be evasive and just kind of let him destroy his own path. Like, so yeah, I mean, at this point in the I don't necessarily remember him protecting any kind of Fire Nation, except for literally in this episode where I don't even know if he was aware that they were Fire Nation when he saves them from that landslide. But stepping in to make sure that people aren't injured is, it has been established.
Mm-hmm. So I guess yes, the answer is yes. I think he made an effort to not just want to save the Earthbenders, but also the Fire Nation as well.
Mm-hmm. So they convince the general, or the resistance leader, to escape with everybody rather than fight back. So they use the pentapusses to make marks on themselves and pass it off as a disease called pentapox. And everybody believes that it's a real thing. And I think there's something to be said there about the spread of false information.
Mandela effect. Yes, yes. So I've heard about it.
Yeah, I've definitely heard of that. Didn't your cousin die of that? So they escape, but along with them, the governor's baby, Tom Tom, escapes as well. And we get a couple of funny moments from that. Sokka says, bad Fire Nation baby, as he tries to play with his sword.
The interaction with him and Momo.
Yeah, the back and forth between him and Momo. Katara makes a comment, oh, you're so cute, you're such a cute little baby. And the resistance leader says, yeah, for now, but when he's older, he'll join the Fire Nation army. You won't think he's so cute then. He'll be a killer.
Mm.
And Aang just, it's the idea that not everything the Fire Nation does is necessarily evil, or at least individual members of the Fire Nation aren't necessarily evil. And when the offer comes to make a trade for the baby for Bumi, the resistance leader says, oh, this sounds like a trap to me. And Aang says, I think they just want their kid back.
It's a baby.
Yeah, it's a baby. Like,
right.
I was really surprised that they were willing to trade the baby. Not to say that the baby wasn't very important, but kind of had an agreement with the Zula, which, like, they're willing to trade a baby for King Bumi, and I don't feel like that's a really fair trade. I thought it was interesting that they were so willing to do it so quickly. They have, obviously, he's an important asset to keep hidden, or else they wouldn't have had him in a metal coffin.
Mm-hmm.
And for this child, they were willing to just whoop, so quickly trade him over because they wanted their kid back. I felt like they could have done something. They could have burned them all down. They could have gone and attacked. They could have gone on the offensive instead of the defensive.
Maybe they figured that since they all had pentapox, they were going to die anyway, so they might as well get their king back.
That was the clever thing to incorporate, the pentapox.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's something to be said there where Aang just says, no, he just wants his kit. Like,
right.
It doesn't get more complicated than that. It doesn't have to be some sort of nefarious trick. It's just a family wants their child.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to make the exchange, but at this point Azula has arrived.
Ooh.
And has said, hey, Mr. Governor, you completely botched this, and I can't believe you think or thought that this would be a trade worth making, or that you let these citizens escape in the first place. And yeah, your daughter's going to handle this so you don't screw it up anymore. Mm-hmm. And we're changing the name of the city to New Ozai after my father. So I do think that there was no ulterior motive from the governor's perspective, but now Azula is going to make sure that things go her way. And her way is not giving the Earth Nation citizens their king back.
You're right.
So it breaks out into an all-out fight. It's funny when Azula first shows up and says, hey, May, I've got a mission for you. May doesn't need to even need an explanation. She just says, I'm in. I need to get out of here.
She was ready.
She also jokes, I hope you're here to kill me or something like that.
She's so miserable.
They start fighting because Azula says, you know what? This doesn't seem like a fair trade to me. A baby for a king? No thanks. You can keep him. We're going to keep our prisoner. And Aang charges. And when she launches lightning at him and he leaps over it into the air and starts flying, the look of shock on her face as she realizes, oh, crap, this is the Avatar.
Shook it.
I don't think it's like a scared, oh, crap. It's like, oh, this is my chance to a certain extent. And so she makes chase and puts in a very good effort. It's an exciting chase scene. We get some of the same kind of music that we got back in the original Omashu episode as they go down the slides. We also got some of that when Tom was going down the slides as he was making his escape too.
Mm-hmm. I forgot about the slides. So yeah. Those were cool.
In this fight, I want to point out a specific moment that just sort of blew my mind when I was watching it earlier today. Katara uses a water whip to break the boards under her feet and launch them up in front of her face as May shoots knives at her.
Yeah.
And so she catches these knives after she's broken these boards with her water. And then she uses that same whip to send the boards out back towards May. And then she circles it back around behind her to catch Ty Lee's foot as she's charging at Sokka with the same water whip. And it's just like this one fluid motion.
She's grown so much.
Snap, throw up, throw back behind. Oh, it's so cool.
I wrote in that fight scene, what caught my eye was that May was going for the kill. Like, there were four knives going straight for Katara's face. All of it was going to vital organs.
It wasn't to May
in the head. Yeah, no, she was not playing around. And so, because when the water came up, like, they slowed it down. The water came up and it was literally right in front of Katara's face. Four knives. And I was just like, okay, May. All right.
And in this fight, we get our first glimpse of what Ty Lee is really capable of, too, because this isn't her being a circus performer and balancing on her hands or on her fingers or walking a tightrope. This is her making chase. She is able to stop Sokka. And then when Katara poses a bigger threat, she takes away her bending. What were your thoughts about that?
And do we know that she got it back, or was it just like a temporary stunning thing? Or
we haven't seen her
try to bend again. And at first I was like, oh my god, she is without her powers. What is she gonna do? Aang really needs her. And then I was like, oh, she's gonna lose her mind as soon as like everything's calmed down from the battle. She's gonna just start losing it. And then she was just like carrying on like it was no big deal. I was like, I mean, I guess she's not worried about it, but what is going to happen? And then we haven't seen her water bend again.
Yeah, we haven't. So, I mean, I guess we'll find out about that in future episodes.
Projection, but that's fine. Cool.
But after that happens, so the way she does it, she like hits some pressure points is what it looks like.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Katara's not able to water bend anymore. And May says, how are you going to fight without your bending? And then all of a sudden, Sokka's boomerang comes into frame, knocks the knives out of May's hand, and he says, I seem to manage. And I was like, oh, yeah, that is such a great line.
Yeah.
It's such a great moment. I feel like
that's a moment where he's finally kind of, he's shown it many times, but he's finally accepted that he doesn't need to be up at the same level as everybody else with their bending powers, that he's capable of still defending and still fighting
right
with the capabilities that he does have. And they're good. They're just as good.
Right. So as they're fighting, like we said, Azula is making chase to Aang and Bumi, and they've made their way onto the slides. And as they progress down the city, it comes to a point where Bumi has to save them, and he earthbends with his chin.
Face. Yeah.
Like his face.
Yeah.
He's like, they didn't cover my face.
That is so amazing. Can you imagine the level of control you have to have over your body for something like that?
I know. I forgot how funny Bumi's character was.
Yeah.
I think in the original episode that we saw Bumi, he was like funny but crazy. He was a little like kooky, but this one he was just really funny to me.
And so as they come to the bottom of the city, they've escaped from Missoula for the moment at least. But this whole time, Bumi was trying to stop Aang. Say, listen, I got to talk to you. We got to discuss some things. And so they have their moment here. And he talks about the concept of Jing, which he says are options in fighting. And the quote is, it's a choice of how you direct your energy. It's positive when attacking. It's negative when retreating. And it's neutral when you do nothing. Aang hadn't heard. He'd only heard of positive and negative. He hadn't heard of neutral.
And apparently there's how many?
85. So let's take the next hour and a half to talk about the other 82 that we haven't heard of.
No.
You're right. That'll be the bonus episode.
There we go.
So Bumi says that this neutral Jing, is the key to earthbending, listening and waiting for the right moment to strike. And so that's what he was doing when he surrendered. He realized that in that moment, had they fought, there would have been loss. Definitely on the earthbending side, but it's safe to say on the firebending side too. Bumi's a wise king. He knows what he's doing. And so he's been biding his time this whole time, hanging around in a metal chamber, unable to, well, we say unable to, definitely able to, but refusing to do anything to escape or to help because he's waiting for the perfect moment to strike. And he says, that's what I'm going to continue to do. I can't leave with you right now, Aang. And as far as earthbending teacher goes, you need to find somebody who has mastered neutral Jing. Somebody who waits and listens before striking.
Who is that going
to
be?
Is that the first time we hear that that's who he needs to find?
That's the first time, yeah.
Okay.
Because up to now, we thought he was trying to find Bumi.
Right.
Because up to now, that's who they said the most powerful earthbender was.
Right.
There is no other mention of somebody who had this other secret ability to, and that's what he said. He's like, the secret to earthbending is
waiting
and listening.
Yeah.
Which is not something he mentioned before. It's whatever. Sorry. I was just like, he didn't care to mention that 20 episodes ago. It's whatever. Well,
he wasn't trying to learn earthbending at the time.
Whatever, Chad.
So after that, Bumi makes his escape. He uses his chin or his nose or whatever to earthbend himself back up to the slide.
He's just like going all the way back up.
Cackling the whole way.
And I'm sure, yeah, and I'm sure no one else thought to cover his face, but he's just like, oh, the fools don't know I can earthbend with my face. And you're just like, no one should. No one should have to. Oh, it's
because earthbending, from what we've seen, is very motion driven.
It's very grounded. It's all about how you plant yourself into the ground.
And move your arms, the force that you push down, and they're. He's like, nobody thought to do this. I was like, yeah, bro. Like, no one thought your chin would have the ability to earthbend. Whatever.
So,
crazy old man.
That's where we leave Aang and the gang is, we've got to find somebody to teach him who's going to wait and listen before they strike.
Yeah.
And that's all the way forward that we have. We get a couple more last moments with Ty Lee and Mei and Azula, though. Ty Lee, for one, hints that there's some sort of history between Mei and Zuko.
Yes, I saw that because she gave that little quirky smirk. Mm. Yeah. Like,
and then Azula confirms that Uncle Iroh and Zuko are no longer her only targets. Aang is her presumed third target.
Right.
And I wanted to ask the question, do you think that her sudden desire to pursue Aang is more about succeeding where Zuko didn't, or for correcting her own failure to capture Aang in New Ozai?
¿Por qué no los dos?
Yeah. Because until this episode, when she comes face to face with the Avatar, she's made no mention of him. Like, that has not been the primary target or objective.
It's been,
I've got to get my brother. I've got to get my uncle.
Right. And I think it's more of a pride thing, presumably, now that it's like her to injury. She's remembering, that was something that I didn't succeed in.
Yeah.
She's just going to do it out of spite. Essentially, just something she didn't do.
Did you have anything to say about that, Andrew?
I would say I would lean toward capturing the Avatar for the sake of it. I feel like Azula already thinks so lowly of Zuko. I think she's just like he's not even on her radar, really. Like, she's tracking him and you know, pursuing him and Uncle Iroh, but ultimately, she's there to establish herself as heir to the throne. She's there to be right-hand man for Fire Lord Ozai. Like, mm-hmm. she's there, you know, obviously she made a claim that Omashu is now new Ozai. Like, I think one-upping Zuko is not only what she's done all her life, but it's just not a motive. It's gravy. It's not a motivation. It's just like, oh, I'm going to do this better than you, like always.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it's the motivator. It's just like, it's what's going to happen. Step aside, brother, because you're obviously a failure. Everyone knows it. Big facts. Let me go on and do this better than you. Like, so I think she's trying to get the Avatar for Ozai. Like, and that's her main motivation there.
Okay. I had just a couple more brief moments to mention before we close. There is a musical moment at the very end of the episode. It's definitely a song that we've heard before. I don't know if we've ever specifically pointed it out, but I wanted to point it out here. It's a song called Avatar's Love. It's just like a simple harp kind of melody, like plucked arpeggios. Mm-hmm. And the moment it plays is when Aang is returning Tom Tom to the governor and his family. And I especially love this scene in light of the conversation from earlier. Aang is acknowledging that even though this baby will grow up Fire Nation, it was more important to reunite a family.
Mm-hmm.
Because the resistance totally could have kept this baby and raised him to be not Fire Nation, right, if they mm-hmm. wanted to, especially considering that they had this deal to get their king back and it didn't go through.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, why should we honor any part of the agreement and just keep the baby for ourselves and raise him to fight against the Fire Nation? So I really love that Aang took that moment to return, and that the piece is called Avatar's Love, and it's about the Avatar's love for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So I really love that moment. And the only other last thing I had to mention is not a story thing, but it's one more voice to mention. Did the baby sound familiar to either of you? I mean, it's
like
a baby.
From the show or from like other baby noises from different movies?
From like
or
other
show?
Other baby noises. Like, this wasn't just like stock baby sounds, I don't think. Or, I mean, I know it wasn't, but.
Mm. No, I can't say that it.
I couldn't place the voice specifically while I was watching, but then in the end credits, I paused and I looked at who was cast, and the voice name, her name is Tara Strong. She is most known as a frequent voice of Harley Quinn over the years, the voice of Timmy Turner in The Fairly Odd Parents, and as Dill Pickles from Rugrats.
Oh. Mm.
She was the voice for Tom Tom. So I just thought that was a fun thing to point out as well.
I was not allowed to watch Rugrats as a child, so I would not put that together.
Interesting.
Mom did not like Angelica.
Fair enough. Well, did you guys have any other closing thoughts about this episode?
Yeah, I think this episode, like with what Bumi is trying to teach Aang, this episode kind of shows the importance of it, because ultimately nothing changed. From the beginning of the episode to the end of the episode,
he still needs to find a teacher.
And did he choose to attack, choose to defend, get into a bunch of stuff? Was it action-packed? Was there a lot of movement and, you know, pull and push and things of that nature? Yeah, it was very busy. But the point was, none of them waited for the right moment to actually do something, to act.
Mm-hmm.
And Bumi's point was, this isn't it. This, we have to be patient, because there will be a time where our efforts will tip the scale, essentially push us in the direction that we want it to go. All y'all acting out, all y'all are doing too much, when ultimately, after all of that, they still have Omashu, Bumi's still captive, baby's back home. Avatar and gang are still looking for an earthbending teacher outside of Omashu.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the same spot when we started in the episode.
Right. I mean, the biggest thing that happened in this episode that does progress further, not in the sense of like we're going to see more of it in future episodes, but just like something happened that did change. It's the citizens of Omashu escaped. Mm-hmm. And so I'm picturing the moment when Aang gets out of Amashu, he returns to the camp, and he says, hey, listen, Bumi could have escaped at any time, and he didn't, and this is why. And for that resistance leader who was so impatient with Bumi and his choices to understand, maybe, finally, okay, I see what's happening. And for him to use his own advantaged position at this point, having escaped from Amashu with his people, let's seek out other earthbenders who are maybe refugees from their own towns. Let's seek out building our resistance and waiting for that moment that our king is talking about to strike and to defend.
Right.
So there are definitely repercussions and further meanings to consider from what Bumi has said to Aang. For everybody.
Right.
And I like that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
I'm excited to find the new earthbending teacher.
Me too. But first, before we close, let's talk about what we think might happen next, because episode 4 of book 2 is called The Swamp.
Why do I feel like it's another fluff episode?
Another fluff episode, you think?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think we might run into in a swamp? Not trying to seek a specific answer, just trying to see what you might be thinking.
Someone who lives in the swamp. They come across somebody who lives there.
Okay. What do you think might be significance of meeting somebody in the swamp? Like, are you thinking this somebody could be the earthbending teacher? Or do you think it might be somebody else?
Kind of like in the situation where we had for the waterbending guy. Wasn't he a secluded, like a recluse in... by himself? He was like
Bato.
Yeah,
well, he was a friend of the father who was left behind because he was injured.
Kind of the same situation with that. Somebody who's secluded on their own, who's found a different way to maybe earthbend with water and earth.
Some sort of like mixed bender. That'd be interesting. Okay, cool. Well, it's another one of those titles that doesn't give us a lot to work with as far as like what to expect, but it gives us a setting. We know that we're going to a swamp. So we'll wait
and
see.
I keep getting like cave vibes. Didn't they have like...
cave?
Like when they went into the cave, the episode before with the drummer, the guitar guy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the Cave of Two Lovers?
Yeah, and weird things were happening in the cave. I feel like weird things are going to happen in the swamp.
Okay, like a place of mystery.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Cool. Well, we'll wait and see what happens in that
we
next episode.
See.
But for now, that is the end of the 23rd episode of Crossroads of Destiny. Thank you all once again for your patience in new episodes coming out and your continued support in listening to the podcast and reviewing the podcast is always much appreciated. If you want to reach out and contact us, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/xroadspod or at xroadspod on Twitter. That's probably the best place, to be honest. You can go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review the show. That helps us to expand our listenership. Something that I'm proud of, I didn't mention this earlier, but if you go to the Apple Podcast app and you search Avatar The Last Airbender, we're the second result at the moment.
What up?
Yeah,
we are right after the official podcast.
I don't want to hear that. That is crazy.
Yeah, so it's super awesome. We love... we love, like I said earlier, we love making the show. Even if it's slow releasing, we always have a good time watching it together and talking about it together. So
for sure.
We're glad to share that with all of you. And we hope to continue to grow that audience. Melanie, where can people find you online?
They can. Yeah. I've slowed down on all of my social media. So if they want to, they can look for me on Instagram. It's MelanieAmanda44.
Yeah. You can see old pictures of Melanie and the occasional picture of Melanie's kids.
The occasional.
I was just like, yeah, it's more
it's always the kids.
Always the kids.
You're welcome if you find it.
The occasional picture of Melanie.
It's mainly about my babies.
And Andrew, as always, the best way to find him is to
contact
seek out
someone
the official
else.
Contact somebody else. If you really need to talk to him, reach out to Chad or me. We'll
yeah, so,
it
so
out.
Ultimately what we're saying is that if you want to get in contact with the show, get in contact with me through either the official Twitter and I'll pass it on.
Yeah.
And then my personal Twitter account is at Chadadada. That is C-H-A-D-A-D-A-D-A. If you want to, you can check out my other podcasts that are relatively inactive right now. There's the Cinescope podcast where we talk about movies. There's An American Workplace where we talked about The Office. Find those wherever And you can find show notes and all contact information for this show at our website, xroadspod.com. Thank you all for listening. We will talk to you in episode 24 when we talk about book 2, chapter 4, The Swamp. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yeah, in the Paku episodes, the firebender teacher.
Zhang Zhang
episodes. He lets General... God, all these names are escaping me right now. Whoever's attacking him.
Zhao.
Commander...
Stop. Was Zhao. I right?
Zhao. Yeah.
That never happens.
That episode was hard. So, going back,